So this is another cup of tea show. Although the show is called A Cup of Tea, it's 8 o'clock in the evening. So myself and Laura Woods are having a drink.
Cheers.
Cheers to you. I'm on a glass of white wine. I think Laura's on cider, is it?
Do you know what? I was going to pretend it was wine because it'd be classier, but it's cider with Ribena in it. And I didn't have a nice glass, so I've literally just stuck it in the biggest wine glass I can get hold of. It's covered in lips. Well,
it looks like an expensive rosé, so or something like that. So
let's go with that, shall we?
But it's suitable that we're having a drink because we are celebrating. But you're celebrating, and we're celebrating for you because you've just got a really exciting new job.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I've just taken over Breakfast Monday to Wednesday on Talksport, and it's a really weird feeling. I've only done my first week. Literally finished it today. Finished the Wednesday show today, and it's still. It still very much feels like, you know, like you're in someone else's house. It very much feels like that. And it will feel like that for a really long time because Alan is an institution, you know, and he's been there for 20 years. And it still doesn't feel right for me taking over. But it's the situation that we're in. He wanted to cut down his hours. And I'm privileged that they thought I was the right person for the job. Hope I am.
I mean, it seems like obviously you've been involved with Talksport for a while, but in terms of this job, it seems like everyone there has been really kind of welcoming in terms of the new role, and everyone's been very lovely from what I've seen.
Yeah, it's been really nice. Like when I first joined Talksport, I think it was probably two seasons ago now, and I came in and I remember being quite scared actually, because I've listened to that show since I was little. And then when you're on it, radio was very new for me. I'd never done radio before, actually. So I'd done TV, but radio felt like a completely different entity. And I don't know if you find that, like the difference between the two platforms is actually quite big. And I went on to do radio. And even though visually you don't have to worry about that so much, even though now they've got cameras everywhere, so you kind of do. But when I joined, it was just your voice that you had to worry about. But there's so much more time. So you sit there and you're sort of like, you know, you do something on TV and it's maybe 2 or 3 minutes long and then you're done, or you throw to something or whatever. And also it's always, you know, the position that we're in, we're usually interviewing somebody else, whereas going on and reviewing the papers that I was doing, and it was only half an hour per show, all of a sudden I had to be really good and really clear and thorough with my research and what I was doing, because ultimately I'm reviewing somebody else's work, and if I get it wrong, I've got their work wrong. You know, they've gone into all this trouble to do all this research, and then I go on and mess it up. So it's hard to do that at 5 a.m. in the morning when you go in and you're trying to, you know, get all of this information crammed in your head. But I just started to love it, and I remember feeling the difference from Twitter. You kind of gauge it, and even though you shouldn't use social media as a huge tool, I think, to tell you whether or not you're doing your job right, because you've got peers in the industry and you've also got the bosses that you work with that will tell you if you're doing it wrong. I did use it slightly because I felt more warmth the longer I did it from the people that follow Twitter and Talksport. But it took a while. And the thing with that audience is if you're nervous, they can hear it. It comes across really clear in radio. So when I started and I was really nervous, they were like sharks to blood, you know, they were like on you immediately. And then I winning them over in some sense. I always say winning that crowd over is probably the biggest achievement really for me, because it is different, and you can't underestimate how different it is for that audience to hear multiple women. You know, they had Georgia Bingham there for a long time. But integrating more and more women gradually was different for them, and it was hard to take for them, definitely.
Yeah. But you're flying the flag now and breakfast host, and that's fantastic. I mean, it's a strange time to take a new job in media, though, isn't it, when everything's kind of strange and there's no actual football to talk about? I mean, you've given yourself another challenge there.
Honestly. I've said to myself, you've got to write down as much of this as possible, because basically what's happened is someone said to me, we're going to give you this amazing job, and in radio, in sports radio, it's the biggest job really that for me they could have given me. And it's like, it's on a sports breakfast show, but there's no sport. So you sit there and you just think, this is either going to be really brilliant or really terrible. And we've had 3 days of it. And I tell you what, it's exhausting because you're thinking of so many different things. We've got half of the crew, less than half the crew that we normally do in that building. So all the little bits and bobs, the show changes, you know, every 5 minutes. We might change the next section that we're doing. It's a 4-hour show. And you're in the morning at 5 a.m. and you go on air at 6 a.m. and you're on till 10. And you've got to fill all that time. And the thing is, I was worried. I was thinking, what on earth are we going to talk about? But we've actually enjoyed it because it's, in a way, it's kind of released the shackles. And what it does is allows us to sort of experiment and find our voices. And it will be different for a really long time. And it will be really different from the audience as well, because, you know, they're used to Big Al and they want Big Al. And he's cut his hours down and that's the way it is. And actually, when I started on Monday, I didn't sleep a wink on Sunday night. I must have got about an hour and I was terrified. And all of a sudden it wasn't the talk sport that I knew. It was a very different talk sport. And you massively get, if you say anything, you know, you will get a reaction on social media for change. Yeah. People don't like change. And I braced myself for it because even though it's an audience that I know and they know me, it wasn't that they knew me in that role. So taking over from Al, it was inevitable. And I was expecting a slight backlash. And it did happen. You've got a real divide between people that really want to support you and see you do well and people that don't want you to do well because they don't like the change and whatever other reasons they have. So day one was really difficult, really difficult. You go in there and you hadn't had any sleep and you can see what people are tweeting because you want to interact with them as well. Like, I always think it's really important, get as many people mentioned on the show because it's all about that audience. And when I was younger and I used to tweet people or not even tweet, we didn't even have it. Like if you text into a radio show or call up or something like that, you want to feel like you're included in it. So yeah. I've always read that. So I want to include them. So I want to read out as many people's tweets as possible. And I find them funny as well. They're brilliant. But then you'll see something really negative and you have to kind of go, right, put it out of your mind, forget it, keep your smile on your face and keep your enthusiasm up. Because if you don't, everyone can hear it and you sound drained and that doesn't make for a very good show at all. So really it's sort of getting over those speed bumps, I suppose we'll call them, getting over the fact that we don't have any sport, trying to embrace it and still make a show and remember that, you know, there's actually more people listening than there normally would be because half the nation aren't at work, more than half the nation. So, you know, you've got this breakfast show that more people are listening to, more people are actually interacting with because they're at home and they've got nothing else to do and you've got no sport. So it's a massive and a completely new main host. So there's a lot of things going on, a lot of things. And it feels like a social experiment, I've got to be honest.
One thing I really admire about you is that you're in this role and it'd be easy thing in the world to sort of keep your head down a little bit, but you're not afraid to call people out when you see sort of especially male behavior that you don't like. So there's been something over the last 24 hours with a boxer who was making a joke about domestic violence, and I know there was something a few weeks ago as well, but that something, and it was a past host of TalkSport said, and you just came out and said that that's not right. And I think that's brave, and you might not, but I think, you know, as you said, like for this new person in this industry, you know, the easiest thing might be to do would be to, you know, not ruffle feathers, you know, not get, you know what I mean, not get involved in things that maybe you don't have to, but you do, and I think that's good.
It's tricky actually, because I know what you're talking about, Billy Joe, and the thing with that is it was very much spur of the moment, so that came up. And look, I'm the host of the show, but it's still an opinion-based show, and that particular thing was about domestic violence, and there are no other women at the time on air, so for sports radio, and I just felt that I felt strongly about it. And I think those are the kind of situations. What I really don't want to do is ever force an opinion out. If I feel like I have a strong opinion about something, it's probably because I have experience in it, or I know somebody that's got experience in it, or I've done my research, or I've followed those kind of stories, and I know a lot about domestic violence. I've read a lot about it. I've never experienced it. I'm so lucky I haven't. But there are so many women that have, and I remember reading this article, and there was a campaign actually, and it was around the time of tournament football, so it was in the Euros, and or is it the World Cup? It was the World Cup, and there were awful statistics, and what they were saying was that when tournament football is on, domestic violence grows, and the actual statistics are horrible, and they're so stark. And I was thinking about it now, when there's no football at all, and it will have the opposite effect in terms of frustrations. You know, I haven't got any figures, I haven't got any facts, any figures. I just thought about it at the time, and I was thinking it will be worse for these women or men, because they are confined to this space. And it just made me think about it. And the thing is, there was a big backlash actually for that. Not huge. There were a lot of people that were really supportive, which was good, but there were backlash, and I couldn't understand why they couldn't understand what I was saying. And what I was saying was that Billy Joe's apology didn't feel to me like he really grasped what he was apologizing for. And I think the importance there is education. So whether or not you think I'm hammering him, what I really wanted to get out the whole thing was an understanding of why it's wrong. Because you look at the comments underneath, and there are a lot of people that don't get why it's wrong. Yeah. You know, it's a joke, everyone's allowed to have a joke, blah, 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 blah. But it's the knock-on effect that it has. And yeah, it did open a lot of conversation. And sometimes when you're on air, and I suppose it's the best way to be, really, you forget you're on air. You forget. I sit in that room, and I genuinely look at whoever's next to me, I look at the producers, and you don't think of the number of people that are listening. And I guess that is, it's the way that you get the most natural reaction of yourself and of the guests that you're with. But yeah, I think you've got to be a bit brave when you work in media, and you have to put your neck out there a little bit. Otherwise, what's the point in being there, I suppose? You have to get a thick skin as well, you know that. Like, we all have to.
No, he's right. I mean, I'm mainly just dealing with Liverpool fans, so it's not too bad. Although I slagged Harry Kane off on Twitter the other day, and Spurs Twitter went for me big time. I would not ever recommend that.
I think it's harder for you, actually, because there's red tape everywhere. Because, you know, you can't really criticise Liverpool. I'm sure you do when they have a bad performance, which isn't very often, really, is it?
Yeah.
But you criticise Liverpool, and you've got all the Liverpool faithful that are going to say, what are you doing? But then if you say anything about anybody else apart from Liverpool, you're going to get jumped on because you're Liverpool.
Yeah.
It's tricky, isn't it?
But hey. Can't complain. I mean, just to pick up on something you said earlier about you know, the medium and how radio was different, because we found that when we first got a radio show, it was very different for us because we'd just done podcasting. So podcasting as long as you want, and you just talk and talk and talk. And then as soon as we did radio, the first advice we got was, you need to get snappier. Do you know what I mean? Like, we were used to doing these big long sentences and trying to sound really clever. And then they were like, and I think it's interesting how you need to think about, and we got a guy called Steve Hardisall who runs Radio City in Liverpool, gave us loads of really good advice. But one thing he said was, you got to think about, if someone's listening to a podcast, they're pressing download, they're choosing to listen to you, they're putting you in your ears, need to listen to it. Whereas radio can be very different, can't it? So people can be listening in the car while they're doing other things, and especially, I suppose it's similar for TV as well, you know, because you're choosing to put it on, you're engaging with it. And it's remembering that people are doing other things, and you're almost kind of fighting for their attention, aren't you?
Yeah, you are. It is really different. When I started on radio, the reason I did it, genuinely, there were two big reasons, and I remember thinking about them. And one of them was that I've always had quite a fascination with radio. And when I was younger, I used to do, me and my cousin Danielle used to make, do you remember cassette players? You put a cassette
in, of course,
record and play at the same time, and it would record whatever you were saying over whatever the tape was. And we used to do our little radio show, and she'd be on a keyboard and she'd have like a jingle, and then I'd be the host. And I honestly wish we still had the tapes, because they were hilarious. Like, looking back at them now, though, I bet they'd be awful but brilliant. So I had this fascination with radio, but I also saw it as a massive challenge, and I didn't see it ever really as anything that I could achieve. I couldn't see myself doing it. My battery's dying, hang on. Give me 1 second, because if I don't plug you in, Amir, then I will unfortunately lose you. So give me 1 second.
No worries.
This doesn't happen with professionals. Oh, here we go. It's because I'm on the source, isn't it? So two reasons. One, I had this like strange passion, obsession, even though I hadn't really done much of it, or any of it. And then The second one was because I didn't feel like I was a very good communicator. And as a broadcaster, that sounds weird, doesn't it? Because I already did TV, but I didn't think I was good enough. I was really rambly, and I'm waffling now, but I suppose it's because I know that I've got time to waffle. And I really wanted it to sharpen my skills, my communication skills, and make every word count. And it really did that. It really did it. I became such a better broadcaster, and it then went over to TV as well. Everything I learned in radio could translate to TV. And the biggest thing I think I learned was confidence, built up confidence, because you're going in and, you know, I was sometimes doing 4 days a week there, 5 days a week. And the more I did, the more confident I got, the more opportunities I got. And you can't look back ever. And I think that's something that you can say for any medium, you know, whatever you're doing, you can't look back or go back or regress. And I think the thing is, when you've got the biggest challenge I think of this job now is the element of social media and getting thick skin. And if you make mistakes, the great thing with radio is it's sort of done, it's in the past. Yeah, and you have time to make it better. So if I made a mistake on TV, and I've done that on Super Sunday before, I've done it loads of times on shows, you don't really have time to make it better, because you might only have two or three bits in the whole show, and then you spend the whole week thinking about that mistake, and then it gets to the next week and you're like, right, I've got to make this better, and it's the only thing you can think of, and then it makes you make a different mistake. Whereas in radio, if I make a mistake, I've got another 15 minute section, and then I've got six more of those, and then I've got this, and you can make it better instantly, and you can have a laugh with it, and the audience are more forgiving because it's fluid. So that confidence that you get from that, it makes you a better communicator, a better broadcaster in anything I think that you're doing, you know, even face to face with people, just everything gets better. It's such a good learning environment, definitely.
Yeah, I love live radio. I miss it. We don't do it anymore. We pre-record now because it's late on a Friday night, and trying to get anyone to go in was a nightmare. So we pre-record now, and I really miss it.
Now you might be able to revisit that, because no one's going out.
Yeah, just go there. There'll be no one there. Put my cell phone.
Come on anytime you like. You can come on at 6 a.m. if you want that one.
Can we talk a little bit more about the TV stuff? And obviously you mentioned there on the way you do Super Sunday with Sky and things. And if you could let people know, if you don't mind, in as much detail as you want about your journey to that, because I think for a lot of us, we just see, oh, there's Laura Woods on the telly and she's always sort of been there. Whereas for you, it was real sort of start from the bottom, now we're here kind of stuff. So if you could just go through that for us, if you don't mind.
It took ages, honestly. It felt like an eternity. I got work experience there when I was younger, Sky. I then went traveling, came back, got more work experience, and I'd done print journalism at university, which is newspapers and magazines, and I thought I wanted to do that. I thought that was my passion. And then I did some work experience at the Croydon Advertiser, and I hated it. Then I got some work experience at Sky Sports, and I was like a kid in a candy shop. I couldn't believe it was just the best thing I'd ever been involved with. I was running on Soccer AM for a week. It was just brilliant. All the old faces that are still there now were there then. Max was a presenter, and Helen was amazing. She was just so welcoming and cool, and I loved it. I just wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to go back and do more, and I wanted to meet other teams, because at Sky what happens is it's all split up into teams, so cricket team, football team, blah blah blah, all these different separate entities, and you can go and do work experience really on any team. It's difficult to get, so it was like you have to be persistent, and while I was there it was very much, I'm going to make teas and coffees, I'm going to offer ideas even if they're crap. But they didn't use any of my ideas, obviously, but they liked the enthusiasm and you kind of putting yourself out there, and I loved it. And went traveling, I couldn't think about it, I couldn't think of anything else, kept emailing. When I got back, eventually I got some more work experience, and went into some on rugby. And then I went on to this team that they call the pub sports team. And it was a quite an affectionate term. Pub sports was snooker, speedway, pool, and darts. And I absolutely loved it. And it was one of the first OBs, which is outside broadcast, one of the first events OBs that we worked on, that I worked on. was the World Championship of Darts. And I was honest, I was just blown away. I walked into Ali Pali, massive stage, Ladbrokes sponsored it at the time, so everything was red. And then this just empty arena with all these tables. And I was like, what is this? But I just wanted it. I was like, this is amazing. And I worked on that team for about 5 or 6 years. And I carried my way through, started off as a runner, production junior, assistant producer, associate producer. Then I started producing on the different sports that we did within that team. And it took me a really long time to convince anybody to let me report. The thing is about reporting is we're all shit. When we start, we all are. I don't know anyone that suddenly picks up a microphone and goes, oh my god, I'm absolutely amazing at this. Like, oh, it's dog shit. And I look back at some of those, like the little videos I used to make, and I'm like, oh, I cringe. But you have to start somewhere. And the way that I did it was, I said to my boss at the time, the boss of darts, I said, look, we have a spare camera, not a live camera doing all the action. It was a behind the scenes camera that we use called ENG. I said, when he's not filming a match, can I borrow him? Can I just go take the camera, do some interviews with the darts players behind the scenes? Because they were funny guys. Yeah. And you don't see post-match interviews with them, but they're quite serious. So behind the scenes, they were really fun. And I had a good rapport with them because I worked on the team for 5 years or so. And he let me do them. And then basically I edited them together. I taught myself how to edit, just did it on my laptop like you guys do, I imagine. Did a voiceover and then put them out on YouTube. And Sky let me put it on Sky's YouTube. And it was before we kind of launched a proper, you know, it was before we did Soccer M Online and all that sort of stuff. That came later. And it just built me up enough confidence and enough of like a showreel to take to other people and say, look, I can engage with people and I can hold an interview. And then I got a job on a kids show at Sky called Game Changers, did bits of reporting there, then Soccer AM Online. I did some NFL pitch side reporting as well for Sky. I did stuff outside. I did as much as I could. I did a lot of free stuff as well and a lot of training. So you do this thing where I bought an iPad holder, like a stand. I'd stick the iPad there and I would film myself for a minute and I'd basically have to give a match report or something like that and then write down all the facts on a bit of paper and then I'd deliver it for a minute and I wasn't allowed to say or anything like that. I wasn't allowed to stumble and I had to remember everything. And to be honest, that's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've never had to do anything like that in TV, but it was really good at, you know, I did it every day and made myself do it every day. And I noticed myself getting better at it. And then eventually Soccer M Online launched and they auditioned me for that. And I started doing all that YouTube stuff and it was amazing. It was, you know, we went to the Euros and even though we didn't have the coverage for the Euros, we just basically went around in this van and interviewed fans. And our whole thing was give a window into the Euros for fans at home that aren't there and let's see what everyone's up to. And it was just wicked. And we did these like 10-minute Facebook lives every day, whether or not there was a game on. And when you get to the knockout section, you know, we had like a few days where there was no games, but we still had to fill this time. So we just got really used to sitting there, me and Adam Smith, who I adore, Smithy. Some of them we were together, some of them we were apart, but we just got really used to sitting there in front of a phone, looking at the comments as well as we were reading it and engaging with them and just having a chat. And it was the first time that I found what I call now like my natural voice. I don't know if, did you find that?
Definitely.
One day it clicks, doesn't it? And you're not putting on somebody else's voice anymore that you think you should be. It's your voice. And it was the breakthrough really that I think I felt like I needed. And then from there, Sky Football started using me more and more. We got a live show in a pub. So everything's always centered around pubs for some reason. And then I went to TalkSport to get more experience. And then gradually they just kept giving me more opportunities. And you have to push for it though. That's the best bit of advice that I can give is you can't sit back and expect anything to come to you because it just won't. And half the time it's because people don't know you want it. You know, I remember when I first started, there was a colleague of mine said, don't say that you want to be a presenter. And I said, why not? I was 22. I just walked in the doors at Sky. I said, why not? I want to be a presenter. And she said, because everybody says that. and they hate hearing it, and it kept me quiet for years. It really did, because I had no idea. I was such a baby when I joined Sky, and I was like, oh God, I want to fall in line and I want to do the hard work. But it kept me quiet for years, and really that was the worst piece of advice anyone has ever given me. If you want to work for it, then it's there for you. You have to work for it though, and let everybody know, because, you know, if you wanted to be a producer or a director, you wouldn't go, oh, I'm not going to tell anyone, like, I don't want anyone to know. You'd go, this is what I want to do, this is my career path, if anyone can help me, brilliant, I'm going to put myself in the best position to make it happen. That's what I should have done from day one. But learning all the different roles at Sky was priceless, really, for me. You know, it makes you understand every job everybody does, and it makes you appreciate them as well.
Yeah, I know, and I agree, because we did an event together, and me and Craig did it in Liverpool, and we both came out and walked out, and we were like, how nice was Lord of Woods? We were like buzzing off how nice you were. But I think that's because, like, you've obviously, you know, you just seem to be so nice with, like, every person. You were making sure we were all right, and you feel comfortable with everything and stuff like that, which you don't kind of always get. And that's not to say people are horrible, but, like, you don't always get that. And is that because, do you think, I've been there first time, I've been, you know, in these roles, so I remember, you know, when you said when Helen Chamberlain was lovely to you, you sort of remember that and how that felt.
Yeah, 100%. There's two things, I think. One of them is that I remember everybody, and I remember who's had time for me and who hasn't. And that's within reason. I wouldn't expect a presenter in the middle of a show to come over when I was a runner and say, tell me about your life story or anything like that. But there's a lot of downtime around TV. You know, you get on site early, and you are running around when you're a youngster and doing the best that you can on barely any money, barely any sleep for a lot of the time. And the hours are long, and you do it because you love it, and you're part of a team, and you're part of something really special, actually. And you immediately feel that way. But I remember everybody that had time for me. And I think that I hated that feeling of not being welcome and treading on anybody's toes and not having the confidence to speak up and say if I wasn't feeling comfortable. So really, I still have that at the back of my mind. Like, if there's somebody new, I have that fear for them. Like, I still feel that little, like, that little niggle where you go, oh God, I hope they're all right. And I think I'm a fairly emotional person anyway. But I like people. I think, you know, it might be the same for you lot. The reason I do the job I do is because I like humans, and I like talking to them and listening to them and finding out who they are and how they got to where they did and where they want to go. So if you don't have an interest in people, I don't think you're going to be a very good presenter. I just don't. I think that the thing that makes somebody a good presenter is probably warmth and patience. There's lots of other things, obviously, but the human qualities, I think, as a presenter are so important. And all the ones that I've ever watched over the years have that warmth.
It was really interesting hearing the story before, because there's several times where you say, oh, I didn't know if I was good enough, but I sort of did it anyway. And I think that's really good advice as well, because when people speak to me, they say, oh, you seem so confident, or don't you ever get nervous? And I'm like, of course I do. I'm nervous most of the time. Do you know what I mean? But I want to do the thing more than the nerves to stop me. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It makes loads of sense. There's something that it sounds mad, but sometimes the reason I want to do something is because I can't do it. So when I started presenting, my old boss was like, he said to me, why do you want to present? You're a really good producer. And I loved producing. It was the creative side of things and the ideas. I absolutely loved it, putting shows together, but I didn't want to be a producer. And the reason I wanted to be a presenter is because it absolutely terrified me. But with that fear comes a real buzz, and I've never got it from anything else. And it's that buzz that makes me want to do it again and again and again. And it makes me want to do it better than I did the last time. And I can't emphasize enough that thing about being really shit when you start. You can't, like, it's not a natural environment. Somebody putting a camera in your face and telling you to be natural and talk to a tiny little lens like this, you can't see anyone. You can't even tell if you're really making eye contact, and it's really unnatural. So trying to be natural in that situation is backwards. So you're always going to be rubbish. And the only way you can get over it is doing it again and again and again. And then watching it back, and that's the most hideous thing. I hate it. I hate watching myself back. But if you don't watch yourself back, you won't see those little things that are easily fixed. You won't go, there was one thing that I remember helped me a lot, and that was you don't always have to make eye contact with that lens. It really bugged me. So the whole time I'd be like this, and then I was like, in conversation we don't always do that. So I don't mind if I'm going in, like, you know, I'm here at Anfield and I'm like, it's wicked. I'm looking up at all these people in the crowd and it's amazing. And then I'm looking at them and it's feeding into what I'm saying, and I'm not thinking about the camera anymore. And obviously you have to regain eye contact, but that was the one thing actually that helped me. You know, don't be so rigid. You can look around, and the most important thing with any presenter is really a personality. Otherwise you might as well just be a puppet, essentially.
So you're still loving it, obviously. You're still loving doing the different things. You kind of, you know, growing all the time by the sounds of it, still kind of learning. And, you know, you've got this kind of new job now, but you must be thinking about other things that you'd like to be doing, you could be doing, I'm sure.
Do you know what? It's so weird at the moment, because Sky is obviously, I've been at Sky for 10 years and I'm still there, but there's no sport. So I'm in this situation where, you know, the two jobs, they sync up perfectly, really, because Monday to Wednesday at TalkSport is the beginning of the week. And then I have a little bit of a break. And then, and you know, the weekend I'm back at Sky. And so when it all comes together, I'm used to working hard. You know, I'm used to working 6-7 days a week and it doesn't really bother me. But this break at the moment, however forced it is, I've suddenly realised how important it is. I had I wasn't very well for 2 weeks and I was inside on my own. And I just got so much organisation done, and I suddenly realised that you, it's so fast paced, isn't it? Football in general, and even in the summers, you don't really get that much time off. There's always something going on, and taking a step back and kind of reevaluating is so important, and it just slowing down for a minute and letting it all sink in. So at the moment, just trying to find my feet with this job, really, and trying to make it my own. I think that will take a really long time. I don't expect it to happen for a really long time. I remember when I started doing Super Sunday, I felt the same way. I felt like I was going into this massively successful and, you know, Sky's flagship show. And I was like, I don't belong in this show. I don't belong here. And it makes you doubt your ability as well. And then it was only when I'd finished a season and started the next season that I had the confidence to go in there and go, okay, fine, I feel like I'm part of it now. So I think it's going to take me a really long time with the breakfast show as well. Even though I've been at TalkSport for 3 seasons now, it's different. It's different stomping ground, and it will take me a really long time. And it will take the listeners a really long time to accept me as well. But I hope it works out. I really do, because I'm so passionate about it, and it's the best job in the world. Like it really is. So yeah, for now, focus on that. Hope that everything blows over and that everyone stays healthy, and then Sky will get the season back on eventually. And then yeah, just kind of mix it up. It's the best thing being able to mix it up. I do miss it. I miss it so much though. Oh, you guys must take your hair out. Just sitting there watching old films and old matches and stuff.
Pretty much, to be honest with you, yeah, doing commentary on old games, yeah, picking them carefully. Well, at least this is normally a very exciting part of the season, so we're doing a lot of sort of on this day stuff. So there's normally, you know, European ones to talk about. I mean, we'll be all right. So just before we let you go, Laura, I just want to sort of get a little bit of a gossip from you, if you like, about a few things. And first of all, someone we love at the Anfield Wrap is Ali McCoist, because he's like a supporter, and what there's nothing worse for football fans than when there's a co-commentator for the football and he's like bored about the whole thing, and he's like, you know, he'd rather be anywhere else. Whereas Ali, he's like one of us in that he's like, I'm being paid to watch the World Cup, this is brilliant.
He was, when I met him, exactly how I thought he was going to be. There is no difference between when he is on camera or on the radio to when he's off of it. And he is so supportive. I've just got a massive place in my heart for Ali McCoist. And for a young woman coming through, is almost, he's just, having him there is a real safety net, and he's just a real support system. And you're right, his enthusiasm, I've never known anything like it. You can sit in that studio at 6 a.m. and be so tired, and as soon as he comes in, that is it. He brightens the whole place up. He's, you know, he's clearing his throat quite often, but, you know, just before we go on air, he's singing, he's laughing, he's getting the giggles, he's going absolutely pink. He's just, his hunger for sport, and not just football. He loves his cricket. I remember last summer he was always trying to get to the Cricket World Cup, and he was calling up his mates, and someone was going, and everybody loves Ali, so everybody's got time for him, and everybody's got a ticket for him. You know, he's just that person that you want around. His hunger for sport and his knowledge is incredible, but his personality is just what makes him. He's infectious. He's infectious, and I'm not surprised you lot love him, because, yeah, like I say, he's the person you want around all the time. He's just that good.
And I've got to ask you as well, obviously you've been up close and personal with a lot of the Liverpool squad, with Jurgen Klopp, so what are those guys like to deal with, and who do you sort of you know, like interviewing in particular?
I've got to be honest, I love your lot, I really do. The most important thing about your lot is the media team. So your press officers are brilliant, and they have always opened their doors, whether it's Sky or Talksport. They've always been so accommodating. And I think it's just because, like, Jurgen's got this thing going on, which you'll know all about. So when you go there, it feels like a family, and it kind of feels a little bit like, it's not a stereotype to say that, that's the wrong word. I don't want it to sound like that's a cliche, because you hear that a lot. You do really feel it when you go there, that the environment there is very special. And it's almost like the press officers and the club are proud to invite you in and say, look, come and meet these guys, come and meet these characters. We've got nothing to hide. We want you to get to know them. And when I started doing more and more interviews, you know, going up to Liverpool, I ended up doing it quite a lot. And we were doing fun interviews, like we were doing quizzes with them, and we were getting to know them. And the players are really open and really honest. The funniest one, though, and probably the most difficult one, was Fabinho and Firmino. Fabinho, and obviously I don't speak Portuguese, but we had this idea, and we were getting these cards, and we were writing a name on it, and it was in Portuguese, and I was going to say it, and then they were going to correct me if I said it wrong, and I said all of them wrong. Stuff like, Amizaji, is that what it's, or I can hear it now, I'm saying Amizaji, and then Firmino would go, Bobby would go, Amizaj. that meant something like friendship or whatever, and then they'd tell us a story about friendship in the club, but they'd obviously say it in Portuguese, and then I'd be sitting there going, okay, and then there's someone would translate it, and then it was so long-winded, but in the end it came out, and they were so funny, they just laughed at me because I was just a prat the whole time, and I can't pronounce anything in Portuguese or say anything, but they were great. Even those interviews were funny. Virgil van Dijk and Joe Gomez, those two together at the beginning of last season. Do you remember before Joe Gomez got injured, you had, like, I think it was four games, four clean sheets at the beginning, maybe it was more, I think that was it at the time though. And they'd formed this amazing partnership, and it was so upsetting when Joe got injured, because he had grown so much alongside Virgil, and those two were brilliant. They were so warm. I met Mo Salah, and I was quite starstruck by that one. But the biggest one was Jurgen. I met Jurgen and had a game of darts. Him and Pep Linders, actually, and it was at Christmas. It was just before we did the World Darts Championships, and I was so starstruck. I was like, right, come on, just compose yourself. And he walked in, and I could feel my cheeks, you know, feel really flushed. But he was so lovely. And I basically was standing next to him, and without realizing it, I was almost sort of just nuzzling up to him in a way. I was just, he's such a big character and a big, like, big presence. I just wanted to stand next to him and look at him. And this is a hilarious photo. Someone froze the frame. And he obviously said something, and I'm literally looking at him, and I'm just absolutely smitten. I just think he's the best thing in football. I think he's amazing. Meeting him was, it was so relaxed. It was good to get him away from football, do something different. And it was, you know, you guys were busy at the time. It was just before Christmas, and it was just nice to see him and Pep in an environment where they were relaxed. It was really lovely. So, yeah, I've got a massive soft spot for your lot. I've got to say, I just think they're brilliant. I think they're a very lovely, welcoming club.
I mean, I'm glad you said that, because we have great experiences with Liverpool in that, you know, we're just fan media at the end of the day, and lots of clubs kind of shove away fan media and almost kind of a bit suspicious of it, really. But we've worked hard for the relationship, don't get me wrong, but, you know, they're so much better to us than they need to be. And so, you know, they could just say, oh, we're only doing, you know, the big boys, you know what I mean? But they have us when they can. We've interviewed Jürgen 3 times now, I think, which is incredible. And if you get how lucky you are, and then you speak to the guys doing the City or United stuff, and they're like, oh, we'll kill for that. And you remember that is rare for a football club to go, do you know what? We will welcome you in, and we will trust you to do stuff. And it says a lot about them, doesn't it?
It does, isn't it? And I also think when you can see, as a club, when you can see the value of fan channels, that's when you know you're on the right track, because setting yourself aside from fan channels, and even just calling them fan channels, you know, it's not like that anymore. You guys are the window to the fan base. What we do as Sky and TalkSport will always be in some way, you know, we only have X amount of time within a show. We might do an interview that's 20 minutes and you might only get to see 4 minutes or 3 minutes or stuff like that. You know, if you guys go in and do an interview, you've got infinite amount of time. And that footage is so important, because there is so much that you can get out of players. It takes a while to get them to relax as well. And I just think the value in fan channels and the value in fans interviewing their heroes, so you get a different angle. You know, our agenda, as some people might call it, I don't think it's an agenda. Our script that we have to follow might be because, for example, this week we need to focus on the amount of clean sheets that Liverpool are keeping. So blah, 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 blah. But there might be a story elsewhere on the pitch, and there might be something interesting to the fans that you guys want to know that doesn't fit in with our show. So there is so much value in all of that. And again, there's an opportunity to get to know players and get to see and hear from them in a way that you wouldn't do on any other platform, really. And I kind of came through that in a way. You know, I worked a little bit with Arsenal TV, even though it's not a fan channel, but Soccer AM felt very much, when we did the YouTube channel, that felt very much like a fan channel in certain ways, because we were unrestricted and they were just like, they just let the kids out the garden and let us go play. You know, it was amazing, really. So, and I've met a lot of you lot. I've worked with a lot of you guys, and we've all sort of grown up together in a way as well. You know, I remember being outside. I felt like I was outside Stamford Bridge every other week, and I'd be just doing fan interviews. And I spent so much time doing fan interviews in my career that I almost feel like we did our own fan channel. You know, I feel that way. So I see the value in it, and I know how hard you work as well. Especially when it's cold and you're standing outside and trying to get someone to interview, they're telling you to fuck off. Especially when it's a loss. But no, I see the value in it massively, and I will always, that's another reason why I will always, when I met you guys as well, I've always got a lot of time for anyone really that does anything in the business like you do.
Well, thanks so much. Just before you go, very last question. I've got to ask you about your social media game. It's very strong, it must be said. Your Twitter's been hilarious during this. I loved your battle with your mattress. Very good.
Honestly, I'm an idiot.
I do have to say, though, I mean, brave is the man, and it is men who do come at you, because you're put down to, I mean, fairly ruthless, aren't they? When did you consciously decide, like, you know, I'm not going to take any shit off these boys, or was it just something that kind of developed over time?
I've always been a little bit like that anyway in life. I've got two big brothers, and I used to, when I was younger as well, I've always been a little bit more, always mates that are blokes. I'm very girly, don't get me wrong. And me and my mates, my girlfriends are very tight, and I can do the girl thing as well, but I'm not afraid to sort of roll up my sleeves and muck in. And I think with social media, a day when it sort of changed, I just remember being on Twitter, and it was when my profile started to grow a little bit and I started to do more. And I just noticed, I was like, someone tweeted me something. I was like, who, what? I was like, I can't have you saying that. And then I remember saying something once, I can't remember what it was, and it was a direct reply to somebody. So I never do it. I don't think I've ever really quote retweeted anyone and called them out, because what I don't want to do, I think it's unfair, even if they say something awful, I think it's unfair, because I'll have a bigger following than they do, and it kind of, you don't know why they're doing it, it opens them up to all sorts of crap. So I never really quote retweet often. I remember I replied to this guy, can't remember what it was. And then when I looked back about an hour later, it had flown and it had suddenly got all these likes and these retweets and all these funny replies. And I was like, oh my God. And then I sort of thought it's actually a way of warning other people off. It's like, don't do that, you know, because you're actually, you think you're really funny and you think it's really cool. And they probably just do it to make them whatever. It was my way of dealing with it in a way. These days I try and do it less and less because I think when you, every now and then I think at some point I'm going to get fired from one of these companies. I'm going to say something and they're going to be like, sorry, what? But yeah, I try and do it less and less, and I try and do it cleanly. But, you know, it's a funny old world, Twitter, isn't it? It really is. And now I kind of see it more as a level of entertainment as well. You've got to live up to your name. Do you know what I mean? You do it enough times. But no, I'm trying to get more professional with it, but we'll see. It's all about balance.
Well, don't get too professional on there because you will be missing out. We'll all be missing out. But thank you so much, Laura, for joining us, for having a drink with me and to sharing some stories and some amazing kind of pieces of advice there as well that I'm sure a lot of people who want to kind of get into your position can take on.
Oh, thank you. It was so lovely to chat to you. And any time. I'm glad we had a little reunion.
Cheers.
Good luck on the way. How are you feeling about the end of the season?
Like, nervous, to be honest with you. Like, every now and again, I talk myself into the fact that they're definitely going to finish it and they must finish it and it'll be fine. And then someone writes something and you go, yeah, look, they're going to finish it. And then, like, your doubts just start creeping in. You're like, oh, what if they don't? What if they just cancel it? And then, obviously, they've cancelled, like, some of the very lower tiers, haven't they? And so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, you can see now I'm like on it, really.
I've said this before as well on TalkSport, you've got to finish the season. There's 10 games left. Even if it means delaying the next season, to me it doesn't make any sense to just chalk off a season. Because if you are a player, I mean, if you're a fan and you've paid all that money to go and see them, you've paid for your season ticket, you've watched it, you've supported them, you've travelled around the country. If you're a player that's got injured in a game and then they chalk that season off, you're sitting there going, I've been out for 10 weeks and now it means nothing. There are so many different reasons. There's so many different arguments to say finish the season. But I just don't understand the value of chalking a season off to start a new one. I don't see the value in it. So I'm on your side with that one, actually. I'd like to see it finished. And I'm an Arsenal fan, so I'm not a Liverpool fan. I have no bias in this because it doesn't mean anything to me. If we were to chalk the season off, it wouldn't mean that Arsenal would finish in a better position than they're in at the moment. So I just think you've got to finish it and credit where it's due. Liverpool have been absolutely phenomenal and they've worked hard. The thing that you guys always do is, under Klopp, learn from something. Oh, there we go.
Sorry. No, that's something else.
Yeah, you learn, don't you? You learn. You got to the Champions League final, you lost it. You went back the next year, you won it. You got to within a point of the Premier League. You lost out to City. You went back the next year when you were stronger. So you learn from it. And I think to not give it to you, I don't think you should be handed it. I think you just got to play it out, play the season out. I don't think you want to be handed it, would you?
No, you want to win it, don't you? You want to win it.
And for everybody else as well, to fight it out, you have to finish the season. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
Laura Woods, an ally there right to the end. We all knew it. One of us.
I'll go on to the cities now and be like, yeah, cancel the season.
lovely to chat. We'll definitely do it again. Thanks so much, Laura. Take it easy.
Take care. See you later.